So obviously it's been a great series, and I'll hand over to Jennifer to talk about knowledge detection and the natural knowledge.
Thank you so much, Paul, and thanks to all of you for coming with me on this journey. In the first lecture, we opened an investigation into the divergence between two natural ways of thinking about knowledge. According to the intuitive, positive way, you easily know from across the room that the person who has just glanced at a clock knows what time it is. And according to the equally forceful, negative way, given that clocks are sometimes broken or stopped and our glancer hasn't looked long enough to tell the difference, it can seem she doesn't know the time. Today we're going to return to that problem with fresh eyes. Last time I argued that the massive computational problem of intuitive knowledge attribution is managed through essentially local calculations, measuring the distance between the current case and established prototypes of knowledge and ignorance. So the positive way of thinking about the clock glancer seems to be situating her near some positive prototypes of learning the time. The negative way of thinking points out a case of error that might equally well seem to be near to her. As an epistemologist, I wonder where she is really and whether there are any facts of the matter about the epistemic space in which we are measuring distances here. I also wonder exactly how and why we are generating these two distinct patterns of intuition, not just for this case, but for an army of related cases where we can swivel between positive and negative instinctive assessments. And I also wonder why this flexibility of ours doesn't lead to incoherence or to a general collapse of our instinctive system of epistemic evaluation. I'd like to start by observing that the instincts you have when you encounter a given situation depend not only on external facts of that situation, but also on your inner condition. So let's return for a moment to our rat from last Wednesday, who was trained in a maze with a mix of goal boxes containing cheese, nothing, water, and carrots. And he had various preferences. He prefers cheese to carrots when he's hungry. We agreed that if this rat was only ever trained when hungry, then under habitual or model-free control, which is procedural in character, he'd just feel inclined to turn left on entering the maze, as that's the direction that has in the past always had highest average reward for him. And under model-free control, he'd feel inclined to do that, even if, for the first time ever, he enters the maze completely sated with food, but thirsty, right? That turning left thing is a habit entrenched by its past propensity to bring reward. Model-free control is quick and easy, but it's inflexible. Old habits die hard. Under model-based control, by contrast, assuming our rat has curiously explored the maze well enough to have a good mental model of it, he can turn right to take the shortest path to the water, even if he has only ever entered this particular maze hungry in the past and never thirsty. He can act strategically using his model of the space to simulate the experience of a new route before he takes it, plotting the shortest path straight from entrance to water goal. And those could be places he's crossed multiple times on his various wanderings, but maybe never in that direct order. He can just use that model to simulate experience for himself and act strategically. What he now expects to be most rewarding is not the sequence of moves that has in the past been most rewarding. He's got declarative knowledge of the maze layout, and that's enabling him to select a new optimal course of action for his present circumstance. That's goal-directed as opposed to habitual behavior. Now, if our rat has been trained in this maze extensively, sometimes when thirsty, sometimes when hungry, he could have values cached for both conditions at the various choice points. Without thinking about it, he could turn left when he enters hungry and right when he enters thirsty. So you can have two sets of habits for a single physical space. I feel like this is, you know, I am that rat in my kitchen at home. You know, I walk in hungry and I kind of head to the fridge. And I don't have any particular goal in mind there. Maybe, you know, I would just return from a trip and at some level I know the fridge is empty, but I'll still do that. If I'm thirsty, I'll turn to where the glasses are and reach for one. And maybe I'd be inclined to do that even if, you know, the water has been shut off and I know it. way to retain the idea that model free control links a state directly to an imperative, this is Peter Diane's idea that the model free control is just procedural in character, would be to essentially consider our rat's whole state representation when he enters the maze to include his own condition of hunger or thirst, right? So that total state of entering hungry triggers a certain behavioral pattern. Strange as it may sound, I think our position when we enter epistemic evaluation is like the position of the well-trained rat entering this maze. Sometimes we enter in one frame of mind, sometimes in another, and we have corresponding instincts to turn in different directions. Our instincts to think in the positive, intuitive way are shaped by extensive experience interacting with agents who are themselves thinking intuitively. And these instincts generally guide us very successfully in that domain. Our instincts to think reflectively are shaped by extensive experience interacting with reflective agents. I'll say more about what intuitive and reflective agents are later. And these instincts generally guide us very successfully with agents operating in that mode. Humans have the capacity to switch between one type of agent or the other. Sometimes we make judgments intuitively, sometimes we make them reflectively. When I was giving you the hard scenarios in lecture one, my mention of problematic decoupled content, like the bus accident, the stop clock, that was flipping the switch towards a certain kind of reflective assessment and simultaneously creating a problem for that assessment. I'm going to argue that it was actually a mistake to apply the reflective mode of epistemic evaluation to an intuitive agent like our stipulated clock glancer. But I also need to explain why this mistake is natural to us, why we don't automatically register it as an error, and why the reflective mode of thinking about mental states isn't generally a source of error when applied in its proper domain, applied to the kind of case that explains its existence in us. Our first step, however, is to get a better sense of how we map epistemic territory. So in animal and human development, a sense of the sensory scopes of others precedes and, in fact, enables a sense of what they do and don't know. I feel like I should also acknowledge this is an idea of, again from Williamson, who suggested that object seeing somehow precedes and enables epistemic adjudication. Okay, so as a warm up to understanding how epistemic territory is marked, we're going to just start with the easier case of mapping visual fields. Not least because visual fields are restricted to the domain of here and now, it's much easier to map someone's current visual field than to map what they currently know. But it's by no means trivial computationally. And I think it's really easy for us to forget this because as human adults, we're so well practiced at it. But visual field calculations draw on a very large range of factors. Body and head direction, eye direction, which is just, that's a very, very tiny stimulus that you're receiving. You're just looking at sort of the asymmetry in the white sclera on either side of the iris. Occlusions, illuminations, maybe mirrors, other complications. Still, walking into a new room and seeing someone new there, we must somehow generalize from past experience with other rooms and other agents to interact with this fresh stranger in a way that takes advantage of the fact that she can see. To get a sense of the complexity of the intuitive calculations here, and just to illustrate literally how far they stretch below the pixel level surface of what's seen, you can play with generating an image of visual attention in a text-to-image generator that's been trained on pairings of textual image captions and visual imagery. So this is, I put this into DALL-E 2, and I put the verbal prompt, a man looking directly at a clay pot in a room brightly illuminated by an oil lamp. Salute to Nyaya epistemology there. And DALL-E 2 came up with the set of images that you see in your handout there. That was a first pass. I was not cherry picking to find the most ridiculous ones. And I think there's something kind of interesting there. So of the four images, only one gets the direction of gaze remotely correct. If you look at the online version of the handout and zoom in, you can see even that second image is actually not great. Some of them are wildly wrong. And I encourage you to play around with DALL-E, play around with Stable Diffusion, with these other text-to-image generators to see how hard it is to map that relationship between a seeing agent and the object that they're seeing. And it's not that DALL-E 2 is a bad image generator. It can get absolutely gorgeous results for semantically very complex prompts. I think the prompt of the giraffe, a giraffe wearing a crown in the style of Alex Colville, something that I find kind of slightly nauseating about it is how much like Alex Colville's clouds those clouds are, and something about the illumination, the way the giraffe is almost lit by, from below. This is uncannily uncannily like his style. Our sharp sense of what people are looking at isn't formed simply by passively scanning many instances of people identified as looking at things, the way that DALL-E 2's very sharp sense of Alex Colville's artistic style is formed by passively scanning many instances of his art, similarly with giraffes. We've got an uncanny hypersensitivity to gaze direction, and that's enabled by a history of interacting with others in contexts where gaze direction matters for action. Okay, stepping back for a second from the narrower field of focal attention to the broader range of seeing, similar lessons apply. It would be really hard to draw a precise line through the border separating what another agent can see from what he can't, nailing all those difficult borderline cases, say on the basis of some generative model of the factors enabling vision. Fortunately, for our practical purposes, engaging visual fields, we don't need to draw that line, and we can help ourselves instead to direct fit model of the type we talked about last time. So sometimes it's important for action that an agent can see something. Sometimes it's important for your action that another agent can't see what you're doing. Those are the cases that we're really focusing on. And to test whether a point is seen or unseen, all we have to do is situate our current observation in the context of past observations with those kinds of parallel computations that we talked about on Monday. If a new point is closer to some point that's clearly within view for the target agent than it is to any point outside view for the target agent, then it's seen by the target agent. Okay, our intuitive mapping of visual field space isn't set in advance to guarantee perfect calculations in the moment. We can be mistaken locating a point within view for a target agent and then discovering, as he fails to respond to our showing, that he's really short-sighted. Or you could locate it outside view and then discover, as he notices it, that he's rigged up a hidden camera. Because these computations are local, error feedback refines our model of the local situation without generating a rule that agents can never see things 5 meters away or can always see behind their backs. We're going to fine-tune our model of the current setting, and with the next fresh agent, we'll revert to our intuitive default, although with enough experience of a certain type, the default will shift, as it shifts for those ravens who are in their densely forested neighborhoods, and they can peer at agents without being seen. So just as your intuitive sense of face space will be different if you live in Korea or if you live in Kenya, you'll be attuned to slightly different ratios in face and so on. So also, your intuitive sense of visual field space could be different if you're interacting heavily with senior citizens or young army snipers or professional magicians. Your diet of error feedback means you're going to be more accurate with members of your familiar club and at a disadvantage in mapping the visual fields of someone far outside it. However, in most conditions, especially in conditions similar to those in which you've trained, you can be not only right, but safely right about whether a person can see a given object or point. Given the way our mapping of sight range space is structured by the ongoing regularities in seeing agents and environments we've encountered. Note also that for some points, you're going to have neither a clear sense that it's seen or unseen. It's going to be in that borderline zone if you don't get a swift appreciation of it as close to seen or close to unseen. And it's partly because we can refrain from judging in those cases where we don't get a swift answer that we are so accurate when we do judge. Okay, now we're ready to talk about epistemic space. So for each agent, there's a set of points inside that agent's epistemic territory. Those are the known points. And a set of points outside the agent's epistemic territory, the unknown points. For any given agent-point pairing, you'll register the point as known if you can swiftly locate it as closer to some known point than to any unknown point, and for that agent. And here, the relevant closeness is in epistemic space. So remember, this can be really high-dimensional space. Remember that the space of face recognition that suffices to get human accuracy could be 128 dimensions. Epistemic space is going to be at least that rich. Points in epistemic space are propositions. These can be specified directly with that clauses or obliquely with as embedded questions. And as we were saying on Monday, you can use devices like quantification to scoop up a bunch of propositions together when you're attributing expertise or something like that. I'm going to try to be consistent and use the expression epistemic territory to refer to what people actually know. One's representation of a person's epistemic territory is one's map of the territory. So maps for individuals we know well are going to, you've got this idea that epistemic space is just this high-dimensional abstract structure parallel to face space, also a high-dimensional abstract structure, and it governs all of our maps of epistemic territory. Maps for individuals we know well will have more detail, but for a wide range of people, I think we can have fairly good maps in which many points are not just accurately but knowledgeably placed either within or outside their territory. I'm sure that no one has a perfect map of anyone's epistemic territory, even their own, maybe especially their own. You can represent yourself as knowing something that you don't in fact know, and I think you can also know something that you don't represent yourself as knowing. Family Feud on that point. Okay. In the last lecture, I suggested that over time, we get adapted to the adaptations of others. So experience familiarizes us with the range of points over which others will tend to be knowledgeable, and the range of points where others will lack knowledge. We don't have to have a prior theory of the shape of epistemic space. We can grab any patterns or cues that in practice help to do this sorting work, situating current instances in the context of past experience on the basis of fundamentally local calculations. At a first pass, some of the main patterns here are topical. So in laying out the concept of epistemic territory, sociologist John Heritage observes that, quote, persons are generally treated as knowing more about their relatives, friends, pets, jobs, and hobbies than others, and that, quote, outside a very specialized context such as psychoanalysis, the thoughts, experiences, hopes, and expectations of individuals are treated as theirs to know and describe. Mapping epistemic territory is hard, but one thing that makes it not completely intractable for us is that facts are not known in isolation. In humans, typically, expertise is somewhat systematic. So if someone has demonstrated that he knows which teams made the quarterfinals in every World Cup back to 1950, you can safely ask him who was in the most recent World Cup final. He is going to know. And that's just like the equivalent of seeing Tom Hanks in three-quarters profile under a pale blue spotlight, when you've seen him under many other kinds of illumination and from many other angles, but never before quite like that. Once you've got a number of clear positives in epistemic space, you should be able to gain the region between these positives. If there's a generalizable type of mental state that we can have only to truths, then the ideal epistemic space should be a structure which enables learnable maps of epistemic territories, maps in which these territories are at least roughly convex. Beyond topical organization of territory, Heritage notes we seem to have some general rules about privileging more recent experience over experience in the distant past and expert opinion over amateur judgment. And so on. Those rules do not have to be posited as brute facts of our knowledge attribution system if they can be learned from repeatedly applying the standard rule that knowledge must get you to the truth over multiple instances. So just as there is Angela Merkel specific variability in the shape of her face under various transformations of pose and expression, so also we find individual differences in the layout of epistemic territory for everyone you will encounter, and we shouldn't expect to have anyone completely mapped. People can have unexpected patches in their epistemic landscapes, maybe psychological blocks having to do with trauma related to Argentina that create pockets of ignorance. Like ocular strokes that can, wipe out little patches of the visual field. But if there were too much unpredictability, we couldn't sustain the ordinary conversational practices that depend on having at least a rough sense of who knows what. Meanwhile, what you learn about an epistemic space from mapping others can aid your mapping of the epistemic territory of a new individual, especially one similar in kind to your target, just as having known many other Northern European women can help you map and learn to recognize Merkel's face. Epistemic space can reflect commonalities in everything from sensory organs to memory to educational systems. It would be weird if a North American adult was unable to compute 5 plus 1, or if the waiters in a restaurant did not know where its restrooms are. Just as in the calculation of seen and unseen points, so also for known and unknown points, we have reward for different actions. For example, for some actions, they're rewarding if the point is known. For other actions, it's rewarding if the point is not known. It's rewarding to tell people things they didn't already know, and to ask them questions to which they do know the answers. And we get continual feedback from our conversational partners on how well we're doing this. Feedback from surprise markers, like, oh, when they gain knowledge from what we've just said, and from the satisfaction of our own curiosity when we ask them questions that they can answer for us. We can also be curious about what they know, feeling drawn to test the harder cases near the border that we are projecting for them. So, next section. I just claimed that our ordinary conversational practices depend on having at least a rough sense of epistemic territory, and here I'm alluding to John Heritage's theory of conversation. Heritage sees ordinary spontaneous conversation as involving patterns of social action, such as tellings and askings, that are only successful if they are recognized by both parties as such. So just as any sale requires one person to play the role of vendor and the other to play purchaser, a successful telling needs an informer and a recipient, and somehow both parties need to decide on the fly who is taking which role, and indeed which type of social action is happening, whether it is an asking or a telling. This might seem trivial, like obviously the speaker's choice of declarative or interrogative syntax is going to do the work. But Heritage says that's not true. He says, quote, real world epistemic status will evidently take precedence over the significance of declarative syntax in determining whether a turn of talk is delivering or asking for information. For a successful act of telling or asking, somehow both sides need to be aware before the speaker opens their mouth who knows more on the point in question. Now, we'll see in a minute that you can also have unsuccessful attempts at telling and asking in which that condition fails, and that we learn from them. So I'm going to go through a little bit of the evidence that he offers for this position. He starts by observing that, so this is in his 2012 epistemic action paper, the observation that declaratives can be used for the social action of asking is not new to him. It goes back at least to Labov and Van Schell in the 70s in their discussion of epistemic asymmetries in conversation, and to Anita Pomerantz's famous paper on fishing for information. So Pomerantz draws a distinction between two levels of knowledge. There's your type one knowledge, of which embraces events in which you were the subject actor, or your own inner feelings and experiences. That's what you have type one knowledge of. And type two knowledge is more indirect. So of the kind gained through inference, testimony, or witnessing the actions of others at a distance. And how you fish, according to Pomerantz, is you make a declarative statement of your type two knowledge to an addressee who has type one knowledge on the same point. So she's got a bunch of examples. I like the one of a casual telephone conversation in which Mark says to Bob, she said that you guys were having a party Friday. So that's declarative syntax, right? But it is not news to Bob that he's having a party. Mark is not informing Bob that he's having a party. He's fishing for confirmation. And Bob appropriately treats this as an act of asking. So he doesn't say, oh, which would be a way of responding to the fact that she's saying that thing about me, right? Which could be news to him. He doesn't respond to it at all. He says, that's correct, right? Getting that it's the embedded content there that matters. He says, that's correct. So it goes without saying that the person who's planning a party knows more about it than the person who's heard about it secondhand. This shared sense of the gradient in epistemic territory between participants enables a shared understanding of what type of social action is happening between them. And you can just play with creating examples for yourself of situations in which you can say a sentence with declarative syntax and falling intonation and have it count as a question. We can explore some of those later. To support his claim that epistemic status generally takes precedence over syntax, Heritage reviews a long series of examples to show systematic ways in which declarative syntax can be used to ask, and interrogative syntax can be used to tell. I mean, most obviously with rhetorical questions, but there are other ways too. These are not boutique exceptions to ordinary ways of talking. So in American English, for example, only about a quarter of questions are marked with those WH question words. And polar yes-no questions typically have declarative syntax, and only half of declarative questions have strongly rising intonation, and a healthy percentage have falling intonation. This is corpus work by Gail Stivers. Heritage draws an extreme conclusion, and I had to leave the italics in the original to give a sense of his urgency on the point. Since any and all aspects of clausal morphosyntax are overwhelmed in their significance for action formation by epistemic status, interactants must at all times be cognizant of what they take to be the real-world distribution of knowledge and rights to knowledge between them as a condition of correctly understanding how clausal utterances are to be interpreted as social actions. This consideration must operate for every single turn at talk that embodies clausal elements, with the exception of imperatively framed utterances. Skipping to the end, epistemic status is a key element of background knowledge that is continually invocable and massively invoked as a means of grasping the actions executed in turns at talk. It is, in short, a primary and unavoidable element of action formation. So Heritage is not saying just that calculations of epistemic status sometimes make a difference to how we understand others. He's making a vastly stronger claim. You set aside non-clausal terms like hello and thanks and imperatives, and all other conversational terms demand evaluation of the participant's epistemic status to function as intelligible actions. In related news, all such conversational terms need to be motivated by the postulation of an epistemic disparity between the parties. So here we need to distinguish between epistemic stance, and that's what a participant signals about their epistemic territory, and epistemic status, which is the actual position of knowledge or ignorance on the point in question. I can take a stance of not knowing, even when I do know a point. For example, when I'm engaged in quiz questioning, I pretend I don't know some very elementary question and ask the class. But it's clear to everybody that that's an act, that's a stance. Participants motivate their turns by taking an epistemic stance that contrasts their presumed epistemic position with that of the addressee. So, I don't know, class, you tell me who wrote the Meditations, right? There are two possibilities here. First, so this is quoting Heritage again, speakers can position themselves in a relatively unknowing or K-minus position relative to others concerning the matter at hand, thereby initiating sequences by inviting or eliciting information from a projectedly more knowing K-plus recipient. Alternatively, knowing K-plus speakers can simply initiate talk concerning the matter at hand, thus launching a sequence, finding warrant for this conduct by projecting their recipients to be in a relatively unknowing K-minus position. And that's something we often do explicitly. We often do this move of, you will never guess what just happened to me. I'm gonna be clear, I'm gonna motivate my turn by saying, you do not know this thing I'm about to tell you. I feel like you do know this next thing I'm about to tell you, but anyway, the motivational force of K-minus initiations is evident in its power to prompt replies. So Gail Stivers, again, this is corpus-based work, she finds fewer than 5% of conversational questions going unanswered, and actually you can carve it way down from 5% if you allow, as a kind of answer, what's called a transformative answer, which instead of answering straight, challenges or updates some presupposition behind the question. So you've got a very strong push to reply if you get that question put your way. K-plus initiations prompt replies of a different sort. Addressees provide verbal signals like oh and yeah, and nonverbal nodding and smiling to indicate either generic acknowledgement of the conversational turn or more specific surprise evaluation of the content of what has just been said. And again, you can test this out for you next time someone tells you something, just sit there absolutely. And I'll, you know, probably try it again and maybe get very annoyed with you. Okay, with either type of initiation, the addressee can accept or reject the status that's been projected onto them. So if someone tries to tell you something on which you're a superior expert, you can respond to their K-plus initiation by treating it as a K-minus phishing move. I feel like people do this in question period sometimes. I love that. You just give a yeah and then an elaboration to sort of make it clear who's the real authority in the house on this point. Reversing the presumed epistemic gradient by replying with more details of what's just been presented by the other party as news. And you don't see that in cases like the Pomeranz party situation, right, where it's clear from the outset to both sides who knows more. It emerges in these contexts where there's a debate about epistemic superiority. My favorite example of this is from a paper by John Herridge and Jeff Raymond. This is Terms of Agreement, Indexing Epistemic Authority and Subordination in Talk and Action. So the conversation is about a Burmese cat, and it is between Abe, who has very recently acquired a Burmese cat, but it is his own pet, and Ben, who has an extensive track record of experience at some distance with a Burmese cat because his neighbor owns a Burmese cat, and so he has been witnessing the behavior of Burmese cats over some extended time. Who should be asking and who should be telling? There's this like kind of battle about it in the conversation. So Abe is telling a story about the aggression of his cat. It's the only cat I ever saw that chased dogs, he says. And when Ben replies by presuming to tell Abe something about the breed, they're fighting fools, those Burmese, Abe staggers for a moment, pardon, and then works to reestablish his epistemic superiority on the topic and pull it back to his particular pet. I know he is, right? So the oh, I know is actually an interesting formulation, right? If you use oh as a marker of surprise, could seem strange that it can be followed by I know, right? Because oh is supposed to indicate knowledge gain. It can also indicate retrieval to current awareness of stored knowledge. It's that feeling of knowledge showing up, right? Heritage elsewhere supplies actually an extended argument to the effect that oh, I know. That's only admissible when what the person has just told you triggers your own prior and independent knowledge on the point in question, right? Like if you honestly don't know someone's name and you ask them and they tell you, you can't do an oh, I know on that, right? That would be very weird. And that's actually why oh, I know is such a beautiful form of confirmation, right? Like when you're gossiping about somebody and it's like they independently arrived at the same conclusion about that guy. So their retrieved knowledge has a foundation independent from yours. That's great. Okay, whether they are accepted or contested, disparities in epistemic stance serve as the hydraulic engine of conversation in Heritage's phrase. So, quote, any turn that formulates a K-plus, K-minus imbalance between participants will warrant the production of talk that redresses the imbalance. So he maintains that either type of gradient is going to start an epistemic seesaw motion that will tend to drive interactional sequences until a claim of equilibrium for all practical purposes is registered by the person who had previously assumed or was assumed to be in the K-minus position. So you've got to keep going at it with your addressee until they're like, oh, okay. Or as a questioner, you ask, and then the other person answers, and you say, oh, thanks, and you indicate that you're level. So you can have satisfaction registered in a few ways. Could be a nod, an okay, an oh. In the end, quote, giving and receiving information are normative warrants for talking, are monitored accordingly, and are kept track of minutely and publicly. It could, in principle, be different, but it is not. So there are two things that I really like about this theoretical framework. One is that it makes outrageously strong claims, right? Every single turn of talk. And the other is that it actually seems to be backed up by the data. So this was very surprising to me when I started looking at this. In lecture 4, I mentioned the new Candor corpus of naturalistic conversation, which shows 1,000 words of back channel. That's the little, oh, okay, all those registration words per hour of conversation with some verbal back channel response for 2/3 of the turns that have 5 or more words in them. And that's conservative because the restriction to verbal back channel is leaving out nodding, smiling, laughing, which also serve as signals of surprise, agreement, and learning. If you factor those back in, you see virtually every conversational turn gets a response. So if you look at that Bevelis 2017 paper, she's finding it at 98% of conversational turns that introduce new information, they get acknowledgement from the addressee. And I'm always like, 98%, and then what happens to those other 2%? The addressee didn't quite hear. It was just like not a successful action, right? To be a successful action, there's got to be delivery and uptake. There's got to be like a selling and a buying. Both of those things have to happen. Now, of course, not all those markers are sending specifically epistemic signals. Conversations work to build affiliation, various other ends, including instrumental ends. And yet, speakers seem to be systematically hypersensitive to the epistemic dimension of back channel. So for example, the contrast between generic continuers like uh-huh and epistemic change of state markers like oh works to enhance knowledge delivery. So speakers who are narrating, this is Tollins and Tree 2014, they tend to carry forward to the next chronological event on hearing a continuer like uh-huh. You're just giving the other person the green light to continue their storytelling. And they tend to drill down and elaborate when they hear an oh, right? Which is really sort of efficient for both parties, right? Because if I'm saying, oh, I'm now learning something from what you've said, tell me more. Meanwhile, even eavesdroppers make use of back channel markings in understanding dialogue. So they anticipate those elaborations after oh and generic continuing after uh-huh. That's Tollins and Partridge 2016. One of the big worries I had as an epistemologist who became interested in back channel was a worry about my own past failure to be aware of the phenomenon. If it's so large and pervasive in talk, how is it possible that I was missing it? Is it like it was somehow designed to like fly under the radar? And the answer to that question is in fact, yes. It is, in a sense, designed to fly under the radar. Okay, I should begin by saying I'm being very liberal with the technical term back channel. If you go back to the beginning, to Viktor Yngve's original 1970 theory, your back channel devices, are used only by the person who doesn't currently have the turn at talk. In contemporary versions, we acknowledge that those markers also get used as freestanding conversational turns and to preface turns and that sort of thing. So in one survey of several large corpora of transcribed conversations, transcription usually often weeds these things out, but this is Neil Norick's work. They find somewhere around half, depending on the kind of conversation it is, could be as low as 30, as high as 65%. Part of it is like, how planned is your speech, right? Which is actually why planned speech, like when someone's reading a talk to you, is like so much more unbearable than unplanned speech, right? Because you don't have those, you don't have the interactivity and you don't have a marking story, guys. Okay. Yeah, there, I did it. I started beginning a conversational term with okay. The way we do that in real life. So in both these roles, whether they are freestanding turns, the freestanding turn of oh, or they're prefacing. Well, that reminds me. What's that doing? It's doing work that's somehow off the main stage of topic focus that's been very much the arena that philosophy's been playing in. So a person starts a turn with oh, or well, and that indicates something about the action that they're taking, but it's very easy as a philosopher just to drop that marker and focus on the truth of valuable content. Backchannel is designed to slide into the background and not get confused with the main stage. Because of its functional role, it's an exception to the general rule that you can't simultaneously produce and consume speech. So like usually your performance collapses if you're trying to speak while you're also listening closely to what someone else is saying. But hearing backchannel from somebody else actually enhances your performance as a speaker. And I, thank Thank you for smiling. Yes. Actually, yeah. I mean, if you've ever had the experience of teaching a class where everybody's just like really checked out, it's quite hard. I'm sure that doesn't happen here at Oxford. Okay. Wait, where am I now? All right. Yeah, actually, also to keep us from tripping up, a lot of back channel even has a phonology that's distinct from English. So the nasalization and mm-hmm, that is not in general a feature of English, the English vowel system, right? But it's just trying to stay off your radar so you don't trip up. You can focus on the content and that other stuff is in the background. We think of languages that have click sounds in their phonology as being, you know, exotic, right? Languages like Zulu have the click sound. Of course, we have it in English as well, but only in back channel. And is everybody like instantly aware of this, right? Like when you think that? Okay, so now I have to try and produce it spontaneously, so actually some, but okay. That was quite faked, but if you're stumbling in a conversational turn, you can to take it back, right? You can, now I really can't do it, but you can practice at home later. It's obvious, there's an obvious efficiency in languages having a marking of that sort to give, be your backspace key, be your delete, and it's clear why you wouldn't want to give the backspace delete role to any, you know, vowel that's also showing up a bunch in your language. You want to have it quite distinct, and a lot of languages are like that with their back channel. Okay. As speakers, so if these sounds and gestures fly below the radar of focal attention to guide our intuitive sense of the kind of action that we're performing, they're nevertheless intuitively integrated into our understanding of speech acts. So as speakers who need to formulate epistemic disparities to motivate our turns of talk, we are constantly hazarding judgments about the epistemic status of our addressees, or checking it with sort of what are called preclearance moves, like, did you hear about? Backchannel delivers extremely rich ongoing feedback about the quality of our epistemic assessments of others, of course, together with the content of their assessments of our tellings and their replies to our askings. In successful discourse, we achieve some patch of symmetry on the field in question. We're aligned that you would know this thing, which is why I asked you. You took it as a genuine question and not a rhetorical one. And now that you've told me the answer, I acknowledge with an, oh, thanks, signaling that I now know this thing too, reconfirming that my original question was genuine. I really didn't know. And it wasn't just a quiz question of the kind that I should respond to with a, yes, very good. In successful conversational actions, what we share is not just the communicated content, but the mapping of epistemic positions that enabled its transfer. And that sharing isn't itself being passed from hand to hand as an assertion. That sharing is something more like the existence of the kind of symmetry that you see in, for example, eye contact, which is necessarily mutual. Eye contact is necessarily mutual because there is the same thing happening on both sides between vision-based creatures of the same sort. There's the same thing happening on both sides between the kind of epistemic mappers that we are in conversation. And we are doing this all day long. We remember from last time some of the data surveyed by Jean-Louis Dessalles in that paper on your reference list. Sheer volume of human conversational time is enormous, a fifth to a third of waking hours, maybe 16,000 words a day, running up to 45,000. Most of it on topics with no immediate instrumental value and skewed towards things that are supposed to be news or surprising. You could actually add in more language activity on top of interactive conversation, like if language activity includes also most of your social media consumption, TV watching, books, attending lectures, like it's getting to be pretty much the whole day, listening to music with lyrics. My argument last week was that all this language activity, especially interactive conversation, is curiosity motivated. And it has the result that we end up building a model of epistemic territory, just as the curiously exploring rat ends up building a model of spatial territory. The rat with a model of spatial territory can think strategically about how to navigate. Hesitating at a T-juncture in a difficult maze, it can use its model to simulate the consequences of going one way or another. And you might ask, how am I getting inside the head of the rat to know that it's simulating? Well, it's not pretty, but they put electrodes in. And if you measure the activation in the hippocampal place cells in the rat as it's wavering, you can see that activation sweeping out along cells corresponding to one path of the maze and then to the other, and actually even culminating in a little bit of striatal reward activation as it hits the carrots and ooh, the cheese if I go that way. Mm-hmm. And it will act then in a way that's proportional to the greater reward that it's anticipating. Anyway, this kind of like imagine if I go that way or that way, that's called vicarious trial and error. Instead of actually getting out there and physically scrambling around the maze, you can scramble around the model in your head, which can be faster, and humans do this as well. So for us, they put us in MRIs while we're playing video games and getting lost in the maze and so on, and they see we do the same thing. After the simulated experience, the better path can be taken. And because the exploration here is like covert, it's mental, it's quicker than easier, not as tiring as physically exploring the world. Like when you hit a roadblock, you could just walk around and like randomly explore other routes in physical space. But if you know the town, you'll probably use imagination to find a good way home strategically. There is still some cost to spending time simulating the possibilities. So as a stable reward landscape becomes very well known, the choice values will be cached and the rat will just run the rat without thinking twice. We seem to be pretty efficient at managing the choice between epistemic actions, where we're, for example, exploring a map, and a mental map, and pragmatic actions. This is the Pezzullo et al. Paper on your handout. I mean, of course, we could engage in epistemic actions all day long, imagining different routes around the maze. No self-respecting rat will do this. But it's important to note that models have value because we can learn from them. For example, you can learn about the fastest way to a new goal or the best way around an obstacle. The human with a model of epistemic territory can also think strategically, using the model to generate simulated experience. We can use the model to predict what others will say or do and to make plans for informing or deceiving them on various points. Even in deception, it's very important to keep track of what one's target already knows and believes in order to act successfully. Having observed someone else's action, you can invert the model to find out the motivational and epistemic states that would produce that action, even when those states are out of line with our own. For example, when the agent is acting on what we recognize to be a false belief, we can do this by simulating the experience that would make sense of the relevant action. Say the person reaching for the now empty container is doing something that would make sense if he knew the desired fruit were located there. And that gives us that kind of decoupled content of the fruit being there that we can contemplate or use in various roles, like putting it in the antecedent of a conditional and so on. When someone tells us something, suppose a friend walks in and says, "Smith got the job," we can, if we trust the person, simply update our model of the world to include that communicated fact. And we typically do this unreflectively. For example, if the friend is a member of the search committee and we locate this fact squarely in their epistemic territory, we treat the speaker as having a state of mind one could only have to truths. However, it's open to us to think strategically instead, using model-based reasoning to explore the question of whether this content is known or perhaps only believed by the speaker, or indeed whether the speaker might have an interest in deceiving us. Our capacity to step up to strategic thinking is a valuable resource in complex circumstances, but it comes with costs. One of the costs is that we can imagine looking down on the subject from a position of epistemic superiority, even if the subject we're considering possesses knowledge. She glances at the clock, which we can't see directly, and she tells us that it's almost 6. And instead of learning about the time, we wonder whether the clock might be broken or whether her speech action is better understood as the expression of a mere belief. He's just parked the car. He tells us it's on Main Street. And instead of updating its location accordingly, we worry about the standing risk of car theft. It's intuitive for us to trust familiar devices and expect inanimate things to stay put. And we'd be in trouble as agents if this were not the case, both if they didn't stay put and also if we didn't have an intuitive expectation that they would. When we looked at animal cognition, we reviewed Hurl and McCormack's arguments to the effect that we share with animals a basic system assigning intuitive durations to things. So we automatically expect the cheese we have just purchased to be in the fridge an hour later when we're home alone and not very hungry. Sorry, I have to keep qualifying. That's not very good. To the extent that these expectations are calibrated by ongoing interactions with the kinds of things whose durations show learnable regularities, our intuitive expectations of duration can even constitute knowledge. The reason why we have them is that things in the world are this way. It's true that sometimes you place a lemon in a box and some interloper swiftly removes it when your back is turned. And in this case, I think we find ourselves in a much more difficult patch of epistemic space. I think we can defend the idea that this is an objectively harder region of epistemic space exactly by highlighting the features of intuitive fitting that the subject is relying on. The situation in which you placed it there and it was still there when you reached a moment later was a simple situation that was solved by your usual intuitive cognition in just the way a non-skeptical observer would expect. Like, we are typically adapted to that kind of state. We're not typically adapted to the quickie interloper case, which is why it's objectively harder. If things get tricky when you look away for a moment, you're in trouble. But the logical possibility of this kind of situation doesn't mean that you lack knowledge in the easy case, any more than the fact that some people have twins means that you can't really recognize anyone who doesn't have a twin. There are times when we do well to reason strategically about what's known and believed, not least cases of conflict. We can allocate epistemic territory to agents in a model-based strategic way. If someone's epistemic status on a point is in doubt, we can challenge them for reasons. This is getting back to the idea that argumentation evolved as a way of enabling communication of knowledge beyond the zones where others have our instinctive trust. So this is roughly the kind of idea that Mercier and Sperber are pushing. If someone tells you her name, you don't need her to give you a supporting argument. You locate people's own names very squarely inside their epistemic territory. If someone's telling you like some kind of complicated philosophical theory, you do ask for argumentation from her. I really wish right now I had more to give you. When we are engaging in reasoning with each other, we use decoupled content, for example, as the antecedents in our conditionals, and we perform actions with that content. Actions of types that are typically persuasive, Mercier and Sperber would argue, and maybe actually something a little stronger. So Mercier and Sperber think we've got this innate argumentative model in us, which incorporates rules of reasoning, logical rules, and those enable us to process the patterns of reason giving that other people give us when they step outside the territory that we'd intuitively assign to them. I wonder if you have to have an innate argumentation module, which has a very specific list of rules that everybody's going to follow. You might think a more economical solution would be to try to anchor the shared acceptance of rules of inference in reinforcement learning again. So just a rule of inference is basically a way of organizing actions on propositional contents. If you discover that some such way is safely truth-preserving, this discovery can win reward. And in fact, could reinforce the practice of inferring that way and accepting inferences of others that are performed that way. In the first lecture, I mentioned a difference between the way we quarantine contents in spatial and in epistemic navigation. Thinking about the hypothetical roadblock out on Banbury Road didn't change your mental map of Oxford or make you in any way inclined to speak or act differently after the scenario was described. Thinking about the hypothetical bus accident, on the other hand, was supposed to make you reluctant to say that Fred knew he was going to be at dinner after the talk. One reason why we suffer failure of quarantine here is that our switches between representations of factive and non-factive mental states demand corresponding switches to our map of reality. Also, more broadly, our epistemic landscape shifts in the course of conversation and private reflection as we reason about our situation and interact with each other. This is a way of gaining knowledge. And that's not true when you're just sort of like playing with your mental model of, you know, the streets of Oxford are not changing out there as you're playing with your mental model, trying to figure out a new route. The kind of reasoning available to us in reflective cognition needs to be reasoning of a type that will only support truths in order to create knowledge. But of course, this can create some restrictions on what we'll be able to embrace in that particular mode of thought. And we may not notice that we are applying reflective cognition in our evaluation of an intuitive agent, partly because our ordinary exercises of reflective cognition are on agents who are themselves, at this point, thinking reflectively too. Okay, so having made some suggestion that we're somehow combining our epistemic forces, not only in learning about the world, but also in epistemic mapping, I want to end with some gesture in the direction of the problem of common knowledge. And I'm going to go back, way back, to 1969, to a paper of Colin Radford's that was recently sent to me by the great Robert Gordon, whose work on common knowledge I heartily recommend. So the paper is entitled Knowing and Telling, and it's very 1969. So it involves three alphabetically named characters, Adrian, who's having an affair with Beatrice, and their neighbor Celia discovers this fact. She can hear through the wall of the flat what's going on, and you know, she writes in her diary about it. So she knows that, Celia knows that Adrian and Beatrice are having an affair. Adrian and Beatrice don't know that Celia knows. But you know, they're very unethical, and they find the diary, and then they know that she knows. Oh, by the way, she's so disturbed by the affair that she sort of reorganizes her flat and moves, you know, her bed and everything further away from that wall, so she doesn't. And she writes about that in her diary too. So anyway, Adrian and Beatrice now know that Celia knows, but Celia doesn't know that she knows until, of course, later. Like, the walls are really thin. She hears them talking about the fact that she knows, and then she knows that they know. And it kind of goes on from there, and there's another diary, and I'm not going to tell you the whole story, but it seems like something quite different has to happen for it to really become out in the open between them. There's actually quite a few iterations you can go through of knowing that someone knows, and they don't know that you know, anyway. But finally, there's this moment when, you know, they just say it out loud. And Radford, I'm going to read this quote of like how things kind of finally break through at the moment of final conversation. If conditions for the transmission of information in face-to-face situations are fairly normal or standard, participants don't require explicit responses to their remarks to believe or justify their belief that their remarks have not only been understood, but, when of the sort found in our examples, accepted. Moreover, participants in most conversations do set out and are entitled to set out on their conversations with the presumption that conditions are normal. That kind of attitude is something you find pretty frequently in discussion of speech acts and so on. So it's just like a manifest fact what someone has said in a conversation. It doesn't require a tokening, an uptake marker, anything of that sort. And that is sort of how you're going to kind of solve the problem, or are you? Actually, Radford sort of pursues the problem further and ends up in a very uncomfortable place at the end of the paper, saying, any adequate account of what is learned and known in the most simple of conversations requires a complex description involving many iterated knows thats. And this in turn leaves us with a major problem, namely, how can conversations and indeed language itself ever have got going? Those were the days when you could just end a paper like that, and yeah, Jay Field accepts it. Anyway, but I just want to make an empirical point about this. It's not true that conversational contributions go without responses. So we can go back to this sort of Janet Bell Ellis work. I mentioned that she's giving it at about 98% your addressee gives you an uptake. There's one more thing about that paper which is really striking, which is that she finds actually a three-step process of calibration, she calls it. So it's not just that the addressee gives an uptake, it's that the speaker acknowledges the addressee's uptake. She's looking a lot at sort of video data and how people react to other people's reactions really interesting to sort of look through how it goes. And I think the sort of causal interaction between two people's activity of making sense of each other and mapping each other's epistemic territory really has the function of kind of uniting their epistemic forces on that point. There is an argument, which I alluded to in the first lecture, from Harvey Letterman to the effect that the classical conception of common knowledge, which requires infinite iterations, we all know that we all know that we all know that P is the case, is something that seems to have the result that it's impossible for people to commonly know any empirical fact. Because if you allow just a little bit of slippage in how much I can know about what you know, and you iterate it enough times, the light from the first proposition that was known gradually fades out with each iteration. So Letterman thinks the proponents of common knowledge as classically conceived and its relatives, I'm quoting now, suppose that when two people meet, their beliefs create a hall of mirrors. Each person's beliefs reflect the world, but also the other's beliefs, which in turn reflect the first person's beliefs, and so on. They imagine that things are positioned in this hall of mirrors, so everything's going to be recognizably represented in each of the reflections. Letterman says, our minds often reflect the world imperfectly. I have argued that the presence of slight aberrations on the surface of each mirror has the consequence that as we move further and further along this sequence of reflections, the original image becomes blurred and ultimately unrecognizable. And I think something that's happening in sort of the classical conception of common knowledge here is that you're essentially seeing the other person as a problem, as a part of the environment, as something that has its own, perhaps very complicated, perhaps very somewhat mistaken representations of how things are. Going back to a theme from our earlier lectures, other agents pose not just problems for us that we have to solve through mind reading. They also provide us with bonuses. They are colleagues and collaborators in our efforts to understand the world. And perhaps if we can share the work of mapping out how reality really is and do so with the help of epistemic mapping equipment that's fundamentally similar in all of us, sort of respecting the collegial position of others, there really could be substantive empirical common knowledge. I think other animals are fundamentally alone epistemically. They might experience surprise as they discover things about the world, but they don't share it with each other, and they don't sort of unite their epistemic systems in the way that we do. In the end, we have each other, and you can ask, like, do we meet each other as mirrors among whom some fading light reverberates? No, we meet as shining lamps jointly illuminating this shared stage. Thank you.